Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. It is Monday, January 13th, 2020. I'm your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have Charlotte Henry. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, hello. Happy Monday.
Is it? I haven't checked.
No, I'm coming from the future. I promise you it's a happy Monday.
Excellent. All right. Not to be confused with Happy Mondays, which is a separate thing entirely.
Also with me, I couldn't stop thinking about that. So thank you for saying that, Kelly.
Hallelujah. Also with me today, fully recovered from CES, I have Dave Hamilton. Hi, Dave.
It is Happy Mondays. That's right.
It is indeed.
So thanks for having me.
All right. So Dave, actually, I want to start with you. We have an interesting bit of malware that is currently rampaging through the internet. And it's called Cable Haunt.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say that it's rampaging through the internet. News about it is rampaging through the internet.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah.
But I wouldn't worry about Cable Haunt for yourself. It is good to know, though, and that's why we're here.
Yes.
This is a potential piece of malware that is able to target cable modems, and the issue is that someone that applied this, and we'll talk about how they can apply it, could potentially cause your modem to redirect you to like malicious sites and things like that. So, and that's a pretty big deal. I don't mean to be dismissive of that. But that's the sort of thing.
The idea of it, is a big deal.
Yes. Yeah. The idea of it is a big deal. If someone can hijack your traffic and send it somewhere else, that could be used for their profit by sending you to an ad supported version of, say, the website you thought you were going to, then the ads get paid to them, or, maybe like grabbing your bank information and things like that. Like those are all sort of in the realm of possibilities when that type of attack is made. Now, we'll talk about why you don't really have to worry too much about this and why also there's not a whole lot you can do. this attack is done via the spectrum analyzer widget, I'll call it that for lack of a better term, that's available in the firmware of some cable modems, right? And so if you have a cable modem, you can go to its diagnostic page. And this is part of the problem, is that the diagnostic page for every cable modem is at exactly the same address. From inside your network, the address is 192.168.100.1. And you can go to that. If you're inside your network on your cable modem, you might have to log in. Oftentimes the login is just, user or admin pass or admin password. They're all very default.
And it's generally a sticker on the bottom of your modem.
Not usually for that, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, for that. Okay.
Yeah, you can Google search and find the
default.
The default for whatever your modem is. And it can be really helpful for troubleshooting things and seeing signal levels and that sort of thing. So we use that pretty regularly over on the Mac Geek Gab side of things while helping folks troubleshoot. There is a portion of that admin interface that will, on some modems, that will show you the spectrum analyzer, so that not only can you see the numbers, but you can actually see like graphs and cool little things. And evidently, modems that use a specific or group of Broadcom chips in it would have this vulnerability where if you attack it from within the local network, so in order to do this attack, you'd need to be inside your local network, but theoretically, you or I could be tricked into doing this locally and maybe cause this problem to happen. So, it's possible. But from within the local network, you can attack this. So no one can attack it from the outside unless they send you an email or a web link that then points you to this. That's why it's not of huge concern yet, and why there's really nothing you can do is because the firmware for your cable modem is not something you get to control. Your internet, even if you own your cable modem, your internet service provider is the one that puts the firmware on there. And there's the reason for that is it's, believe it or not, your cable modem that decides how fast it will let your network talk on the internet. So if you had control over the firmware, you'd buy, from Xfinity or Comcast, you'd buy the cheapest plan you could and then just tell your modem, ratchet up the speeds, let's go. And it would, because your modem is the thing that makes that decision. Mm-hmm. So
Oh, hey, super fast broadband.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, as I pay for dial-up modem speed. Wink, wink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, pay for dial-up and then, yeah, exactly. And then crank it up. And there have been, you know, people that have figured out ways in the past. I don't know if there's anything current that would work to hack your own firmware into the modem to do that. But in general, you do not get to upload firmware to your modem when you plug into the cable network for the first time. You authenticate. It figures out that modem is yours. Then it looks up in the system what service does Dave pay for, and then it slurps down that, or it pushes down that firmware to the modem, and now your modem is running an Xfinity branded firmware that defines my gigabit, you know, cable speeds or whatever, because that's what I pay for. So in order for this to be fixed, Comcast needs to push out a firmware, I think, that either blocks this hole or it blocks the spectrum analyzer entirely. What's interesting is that the modem I'm currently running, which is the Netgear CM1000, has a spectrum analyzer in it, but I can't get to it because the Comcast firmware has been blocking it for a long time. My Motorola DOCSIS 3.1 modem, the model of which I can't remember off the top of my head, the firmware that Comcast pushed to that did not block the spectrum analyzer. So I was able to use the spectrum analyzer in my Motorola, in my Motorola firmware. I don't know if that's still the case. It sounds like it won't be for long regardless. So that's the part that's a little weird to me, is the researchers say that if, for example, my modem, the Netgear CM1000, is on the list of potentially vulnerable ones. But I think Comcast is already blocking the spectrum analyzer here and has been for years. So, but regardless, we would need to wait for that to happen. The only thing to do is that firmware updates generally are not pushed to your modem randomly. They are pushed to your modem during the startup process. And this is why when you change your speeds, your cable company tells you to power cycle your modem, or they can sometimes remotely trigger a power cycle of your modem. So that essentially a reboot. That's the only time that the firmware is pulled down. So the thing would be to wait, watch the news. We'll publish something as soon as we know anything. And then you might want to sort of force restart your modem by pulling power, wait 10 seconds, plug it back in and let it reboot. And every time your modem boots, it pulls down new firmware. So even if it's the same one it had previously. So that's a way of forcing your modem to do that. And you probably, sort of as an aside, that's not a bad thing to do on a semi-regular basis. I would say, you know, somewhere between 2 and 4 times per year, it is good to reboot your cable modem, because there are things that are pushed out in the firmware. If it's a really important security update, like I said, your provider might trigger a reboot to make you get it faster. But I've had lots of experience with folks who, you know, Comcast ups their speeds all the time, even for the same plan, like whatever you're paying for might get faster. And there was a period in time where they were doing that pretty regularly. And you wouldn't get those speeds unless you just restarted your cable modem. And that's all you needed to do was restart it. And then suddenly you'd have, you know, whatever the speeds of your current tier were. So,
yeah.
So it is worth doing that a few times a year.
So yeah, every once in a while. Yeah.
Yeah, every once in a while. Yeah, once a week is probably way too much.
No.
It's not going to hurt anything, but, you know, yeah.
On a slide note, obviously I don't have Comcast because I'm here in the UK, but my internet provider, as it happens, is British Telecom, which also provides my television. And some of the channels, particularly like the sports channels and stuff run by BT, are not aerial, but they obviously run on the internet, right? And so often I found that, like, you get a hazy signal, as you're describing, Dave. You restart the modem, you pull everything out and start again, and suddenly I've got beautiful 4K sport on my channel. And the power of a restart, hey?
Yeah, well, yeah. And I mean, there's more that happens in a restart than just the firmware update, of course.
Of course.
You know, it resyncs perhaps with a different channel. One way of thinking about your cable modem, and this sort of changes as we move into DOCSIS 3.1 territory, but not really, is that your cable modem just tunes to a different channel or set of channels.
Yeah.
And there are many from which it can choose. And so it, you know, if there's interference on one or because of whatever, these are all, there's physics involved, right? And we're talking about wires and cables and things that are affected in the material world, that when you reboot, it looks at that a little more aggressively. It says, where's the best signal I can find? And then it locks into it. Once it's locked in, it's not constantly obsessing over, do I need to change? Do I need to change? Do I need? No, no. Wi-Fi does that more frequently.
And of course, in the example I'm explaining, it's sending an awful lot of data down the wires and cables and dealing with the physics that you're outlining. Yeah. Like if you're getting 4K TV through your modem, that's a lot of data.
It is a lot of data. And it's a lot of sustained data is
correct.
What it is.
Yeah.
It's got to be consistent. Yep.
Right. We have the same kind of issues here, but like every so often, and I don't even, and not once a week, probably not even once a month, because it's gotten better. It's just a matter of like, you can tell nothing's working quite right. Maybe some TV is weird. Maybe, network connections are really slow. Like at my house anyway, the Echo Base will every once in a while act like it turned on a light or something, but it never actually worked. Go pull the cable on the power cable off the modem, count to three, put it back in, wait a little bit, and then everything's fine again. And it's just every once in a while a thing that sort of has to happen. So
I always say count to 10. Kelly, you're totally right that counting to three is enough time. But a lot of people, we're all impatient people. And so I force myself to count to 10 because I can count to 10 really fast and I can count to 10 really faster. So if I pull it out and I go 1, 2, 3 and I plug it back in, that might not be enough time to let things just sort of chill. Like there's capacitors in there.
I'm not counting that fast.
but some people do. And that's why I always say wait 10 seconds because, you know, seconds are sort of a fluid measurement. Time is flexible in those regards. So,
yes.
So give it enough time that you're not, surging into a capacitor that might not like it. Cable modems generate a lot of heat.
They do.
So yes.
It's good to just like chill for a second and then plug it back in.
Yeah. Give it some time. Give it some air.
Yeah.
So I'm glad we got a chance to talk about that because, first of all, I know, Dave, you've mentioned it before, and I'd forgotten that your service provider is responsible for the firmware on your modem, whether you bought it or not. And also to take a little bit to talk about this attack and how it's not necessarily as big a deal as the headlines would leave you to believe it is.
Right.
So we like to make sure that
I'm
we talk about all of them in the... In that context. So sometimes it's a really big deal and we want to make sure you know it's a really big deal. And sometimes it sounds like a big deal, but it may not actually be that big a deal. So we try to make sure everyone's appropriately concerned here at Daily Observations.
Also, if you want to know more about modems, listen to Matt Geekgab. They like modems.
We do. Kind of a lot.
We're
a little obsessive. Yeah. In fact, there was a Netgear modem that I saw at CES that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to put up a little piece about, I still have a couple of things from CES to publish and that is one of them. The whole, and a couple other, like it's a modem that has Wi-Fi 6 capabilities built into it that you can purchase on your own, which is awesome. Right. So all in one, you're saving money because you're not paying your $10 a month rental fee and all of that good stuff. So yeah. Good stuff. Yeah.
Told you he likes modems.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep,
a lot.
For sure.
Yeah.
So
thank you, Dave. I'm really glad to hear about all that. And I'm actually looking forward to the Netgear one. I know we just bought a modem, but I'm like, maybe I need a new modem.
Well, maybe not. I mean,
definitely not. I'm not going to be allowed to buy one less than a year in. Like, we have not gotten the mileage out of this one yet. So,
the thing is, here's the deal. Wi-Fi 6 lets you go faster than, potentially, you can go faster than a gigabit, right? So faster than gigabit Ethernet with Wi-Fi 6. if you have a Comcast, and this might be true of other providers too, but Comcast's quote unquote gigabit connection is actually, and I love that it's this number, 1.21 gigabits, not gigawatts, but 1.21 gigabits per second is your downstream speed that you get provisioned into your modem from Comcast when you have a gigabit connection. However, if you have your modem connected to a router via a single Ethernet cable, you are limited to 1 gigabit per second because that's gigabit Ethernet. So there are a couple of ways to solve that particular problem. Some is using, like, you know, bonding to Ethernet channels and that sort of thing, if both your modem and your router support that. But if your router is inside your modem and your modem is a DOCSIS 3.1 modem and you have this gigabit service with 1.21 gigabits per second down, and your modem has your wireless access point in it and your router, well, now they are connected at faster than gigabit speed. So potentially with your iPhone's 11, you could be downloading faster than 1 gigabit per second over the internet if all the pieces are come in line together, because your iPhone's 11 are the only Apple devices that currently support Wi-Fi 6.
Yes.
So there you go. That's your straight from CES dissection of that, which is kind of cool. You know,
I mean, it sounds like, really cool. Yeah.
I don't know that I need that kind of, like, I don't know if it's worth going through a lot of trouble to make sure I have the potential for that kind of speed with my iPhone. I don't even know if it's worth that kind of trouble to have that speed for my Mac, to be perfectly blunt about it. Like, I don't know how much speed we need, but this is where the world's going. So we will eventually, you know, but that, to be perfectly honest, I need to chastise myself. That's the wrong way to look at it. Until we have the speed available, we won't create the things that use that speed.
That use that speed, yeah.
Right. Like, video conferencing is an awesome thing, but when we were on dial-up modems, you could sort of do it, but it was a pain in the neck. You know, it wasn't really any good.
It was terrible. Yeah.
Right. It was terrible. And so until we had the speed in our connections to do video conferencing, we thought it was a stupid thing, because why would you need more speed? Right. You know, well, that's why. You got to get there first. Then,
for the record, I kind of still think it's stupid sometimes.
Well, there you go. I meant the speed. We thought,
not when I get to talk to you guys, but other times.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because some of those meetings are. So, also, like Dave said, he went to CES. I know you guys heard about it last week on the show. You can find out more. Like Dave said, there's still some stuff yet to be published. There will be more CES coverage on our site. You can find out more about that stuff over at MacObserver.com. Also, over at MacObserver.com, we had a nice piece, Charlotte, that you wrote up about the iPod blast from the past.
So, well, it is, and I like this. So it is not a particularly new story. It is Tony Fadell's, a former SVP at Apple. He recounted the timeline that original iPod was created on. It's staggering. It was less than a year. It was kind of first week of January, shipped to customers kind of first week of November. It's staggering. But we've heard this story before. It came back to the forefront because Patrick Collison, the CEO of Stripe, shared it in quite a lot of detail. You can see his tweet on the site. First of all, the iPod means a lot to me just because it was the first ever Apple device I got. It's the one that kind of brought me into Apple. I think I had the black color screen one.
Yeah,
love it. Still have it somewhere. Still works.
Yeah.
But what was astounding about this is not just how much I love the original iPod, but literally, Tony Fadell turned up at Apple in January 2001, and all they had was the idea for a hard drive based MP3 player. Steve Jobs didn't get pitched the idea till March. It arrived with shipped to customers in November. And I think it's a really fascinating thing how Apple could move so quickly. And, like, you know, I wasn't really aware of the story. I know other people have. It's been floating around for a while. But it struck me, you know, we've spent a lot of time on these shows, Kelly, complaining that we didn't get a new XYZ for 2 years or whatever. Hi, MacBook Pros. But when you see something like this, it reminds you just quite what an innovative, amazing company Apple can be when it really wants to be, when everything clicks into gear. It's kind of like the modem setup that Dave was describing. Once everything clicks into gear, yes, you can get super fast speeds. But also, it just struck me as someone who hadn't really heard this story before, quite how this kind of game-changing, industry-changing product arrived in less than 12 months. I mean,
realistically, it's really was shorter than that because it was a thing that totally existed well before people got their hands on them.
Of course, because Steve Jobs showed it.
Right. It was launched at the end of October. And so that's like 10 months.
Right. And now we see companies faffing around with alpha stages and beta stages and public beta stages and this and that. And it's like, just product. Mm-hmm. Let's go. If you have a thing that's good enough, bring it to the people.
Yeah. Dave, you were around for that. So.
I was. Yeah. At the time, nobody realized how quickly it all came together, right? I mean, that was only a story told after the fact. But
yeah.
But
yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
And MP3 players were, as with almost every product that Apple releases, the category is not ever new, right?
No, so I had a different company's MP3 player for ages before I got the iPod.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I thought they were stupid, because they were. That's the thing. It was like, it's such a pain. I mean, it's cool, but, you'd get it and then you'd have to spend all this time sort of like shoving your data onto it. Yeah. And then once you got your stuff onto it, you were like, I never want to go through that again. So you'd just be stuck with the same song. It was like, it was no better and arguably worse than making mixtapes. Because that's essentially what you would do is you'd be like, all right, here are the songs that I want to take with me. Great. Got it. And then you'd take them with you. And it's like, I got to make another mixtape. And it'd take you an hour just to do everything and all that stuff, you know? So when Apple came out with it and they're like, and they showed that it was the size of a hard drive. I was like, what? That's so stupid. Who wants to have all that music with them? Well, evidently, me and pretty much everybody else. So it wasn't as stupid, but that's the point, right? Sometimes you don't know what you need until it exists. And
I find that really fascinating because I'd have thought of all the people in the world that would really want 1,000 songs in their pocket. You would be high up that list.
Right. No, as it turns out, I am. You're not wrong. I just didn't realize it
at first. Right.
Yeah, because I had experience with the less good experience of these things. You know.
As did I, and I was not excited about $500 to do that same thing.
Right.
That I was doing with the much cheaper thing because it still kind of sucked. So
it's just here's
the CS kind of link to this. I was thinking about this as I was reading through this staggering timeline. Like, this is super quick. The kind of products and companies you are meeting at CS, you know, in the startup space or even more advanced companies, Dave, they're spending a lot longer than 10 months making their major products, right?
Most of the time, yes, that's true. Not everything, but certainly, you know, some of them, but like case companies, for example, right? Like those things turn around pretty quickly.
Of course. Yeah.
In a general sense, but those are just like, let's iterate on the theme sort of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. But the things where, like, for example, I saw this company, it was a total happenstance meeting on a bus, but I met with the CEO of a company called Elliptic Labs, and she showed me their tech, which is just software. I mean, I say just software. It leverages the microphone and cameras. Sorry, that's wrong. It leverages the microphone and speakers in a smartphone. The software has to be installed on the phone, but it uses ultrasound via the microphone and speakers to detect proximity to the phone. right? Using essentially, you know, echolocation or sonar, whatever you want to call it, but it's sending out ultrasound and it's listening. And based on the way it comes back in, they sort of know, ah, something's closer or further away from the screen. So you don't need an IR sensor, for example, to detect whether the phone is near your face. That's cool from a cost standpoint and also a power usage standpoint, right? That's a valuable thing. They even said they could detect heartbeat with this, but they've been working on this software for 8 years. And yes, it is now being used and they're continuing to iterate on it, but it's not something, it's a great idea. It makes a lot of sense. You know, when somebody points it out, it's very difficult because there's a lot of math involved. But you know, it's not something they cooked up in 2 months. So right. Yeah, it takes time. Yeah. So there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is like, for me, this is sort of the new yardstick of how long a thing takes, because the thing I used to remember was Disneyland was like 18 months.
Yeah,
from
I just
Orange Groves to fully finished, we've opened the gates and there are people in the park, was a year and a half. So, yeah.
I just wonder if sometimes companies could be a little bit braver. And I'm not even talking about, what is that, this lean startup thing where you just get something out. I'm not even talking about that. I just wonder if sometimes companies are so scared of failing that they don't get the thing out there and it's kind of slightly misses the boat. I don't know.
I think you might be half right. I think they're afraid of being dragged by the tech press if it's terrible.
Yeah.
And not getting the opportunity to iterate.
There's the perfect is the enemy of good mentality, right? And the whole concept, and it's really like, it's easy to sit here and say, but having been through it with some other projects, the whole concept of MVP, the minimally viable product, is really difficult to focus on when you are building the thing and you know, oh, we could also use this to do, you know, C, D, E, F, and G. And it's like, no, A and B. Yes, that's true. But A and B, and maybe even just A, are all we need for it to be viable.
Yeah.
Get it fixed. Make that work well. Perfect is, you don't want to say that, but then make that work well, make that work reliably and get it out there and then continue. Don't slow down.
Right.
Continue iterating, keep doing your thing. And that way you've got, you know, you've got a company as opposed to just an idea and burning a lot of money. So,
Yeah, that tends to be the difference. So, and you can hear Dave tell you more about that on the Small Business Show, which is a very good thing that you should be doing.
Sure.
But if you're not listening to that, you should be.
But yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. But so. Definitely worth listening to. Anyway, so that's going to do it for us today. If you want to find out more, or if there was, if you have questions about the Cable Haunt flaw or anything like that, you can always get a hold of us at observations@macobserver.com. You can catch us at TMO Daily on Twitter, and you can leave a comment in the show notes. And I want to thank both of you for being here today. Dave, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me. And of course, thanks to all our CES sponsors for making our coverage last week possible. It was amazing. Text Expander, Bombix Software, and Otherworld Computing, of course. So thanks to all of them.
Yes, we do love Otherworld Computing. Just as a general rule, aside from CES sponsorship, they're just pretty great.
It's very true. Yeah.
And also with me today, Charlotte Henry. Thank you for being here, Charlotte.
Thank you. And also glad that Dave is back in one piece. So that's good.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Because, you know, some people get broked by CES.
That's true.
Lots.
Yeah, more than a few. I'm your host, Kelly Gamont. I will talk to all of you tomorrow. In the meantime, be excellent to each other.